right, and welcome to Fast Break Breakfast, NBA Podcast, Summer Solo Edition. My name is Keith, here alone once again without my co-hosts John and Chuck. Today's episode is all about the Utah Jazz, and we can jump right into that after I tell you about the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. They've been pumping out like three episodes a week all summer, doing an entertaining job of shining light on the NBA's entertaining an interesting history. They just put out three episodes all about Dr. J, so check those out and subscribe to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Also, we are still doing a Fan Essentials giveaway. We gave out a box of Fan Essentials team gear to a Sacramento Kings fan last week, and we will be doing a giveaway all September long. For anyone who writes us a five-star iTunes review, you will be entered into a drawing for a free box. And here's the thing, not that many people write iTunes reviews, so it's a good chance to give yourself some good odds of winning free gear for your favorite team. Also, go to fanessentials.net and use the code FBBF when you order to get 30% off. Fanessentials.net, get all the essentials you need. All right, one more commercial, and then we will be talking Utah Jazz, and you can skip to that in 3, 2, 1. My guest today is the Utah Jazz beat writer for KSL.com and the managing editor of the jazz blog Salt City Hoops, Mr. Andy Larson. How are you doing today?
Doing well. It's a beautiful day here in Salt Lake, so it's good.
That's good to hear. I've never been, well, as far as I've been into Utah is on foot at the Four Corners Monument.
Okay.
So I feel like Utah is kind of its own place, almost like a foreign country, but I don't know if that's just based on preconceived notions or stereotypes I have. Is that the case, or is it just, you know, kind of same as everywhere else?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's mostly the same as everywhere else. I mean, like, rural Utah is a little bit weird, right? But then, like, rural Nevada is also a really strange place. So, like,
oh, no doubt.
I mean, Salt Lake City for its part is a super modern city with, like, you know, a Democratic mayor and you know, a mostly non-Mormon population that has pro sports teams like the Utah Jazz.
Right. So all that, there's nothing for an NBA player to do. Is that all overblown, or is it just still part of the community?
I mean, look, it's not L.A., it's not New York, but I think you talk to most people on the NBA circuit, and they'll tell you, like, Oklahoma City is probably a worse place to visit just from a things-to-do point of view. Sacramento, Milwaukee, I've heard those kind of things. But actually, you talk to the players who live in Salt Lake and, you know, hang out here, and there is stuff for them to do, and they seem to like it here a lot. So, and maybe that's just me being defensive about my hometown, and there's probably a little bit of that, too, but... It's like a reasonable place reasonable people live.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you could tell me anything about Salt Lake City, I think I would believe it. But yeah, you assume
it's 11 out of 10.
11 out of 10. Fantastic. Well, I'll take that as a Spinal Tap reference. We have a tradition of normally starting with talking about our breakfast. Did you have a chance to eat breakfast today?
No, I'm like not a usual breakfast eater. Like the best part about being being someone who focuses on basketball full time is that you don't have to get up at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And so, I get up at like 10 o'clock and go to work, and, you know, generally lunch is my first meal of the day. If I'm doing breakfast, it's usually in a brunch situation, though, which means that maybe the quantity of breakfast I have is not that much, but the quality of breakfast is usually pretty superb.
That's good. When you're getting brunch, what's your go-to move?
I'm a big waffle guy. If it's like a Belgian waffle with fruit on top of it, definitely that. Like crepes or like Swedish pancakes, those are great. Anything with like fresh fruit on it, I'm definitely in on.
That's pretty good. We're here in Nashville, Tennessee, and our big thing that seems to be our export now food-wise is hot chicken. So I don't know if you've ever had a chance to have hot chicken and waffles. It's a big thing, and it's fantastic.
I haven't. And there are a couple of restaurants here that serve it, and I've always been like too nervous to order it just because it seems weird, right? But you tell me it's good.
Man, you just got to go for it. Got to live that life.
Okay.
All right. Before we get to basketball, one more perpetuating stereotypes question.
Does anyone in Salt Lake City actually listen to jazz? And that's noting that the Charlie Brown theme song and Dave Brubeck's Take Five are not jazz.
What? I mean, the answer is no. There are no jazz clubs. There might be a jazz club here, but no, it's not a thing people listen to here. I mean, yeah, culturally, demographically, it's the jazz are not music. Jazz is not a thing here.
Could you ever see any scenario where the name would change, or is it just so interwoven into like lore and positive history that they're always going to stick with it?
Yeah, I think they'll stick with it for essentially forever for the reasons you said. You know, people know the name Utah Jazz. They already have that love and affiliation towards it. But yeah, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So don't a lot of other NBA team names. But the feelings people have, the old gear people have, the successful seasons the Jazz have had, I mean, that it definitely makes more sense to keep the name than not. And that should be true for the foreseeable future.
Yep. So you say that's your hometown. So you've been a lifelong jazz fan?
Yeah. Yeah. Grew up here, like saved my summer job money when I was in high school and bought season tickets, and then just kind of started blogging about the team and ended up getting hired eventually. So, I've always been a jazz fan since I can remember, really.
That's great. Talking about that history, what's your favorite past jazz memory, or what was your favorite jazz team?
I mean, probably, this is weird, but maybe my favorite team was a not winning team. The year after Stockton and Malone retired, there's the Andre Kirilenko led, Carlos Arroyo led, 03-04 Utah Jazz that won 40 games and didn't make the playoffs. But every publication said that they'd be the worst team in the league, worst team in history, right? Like, this is a team that has, you know, like I said, Carlos Arroyo is your starting point guard. Jaron Collins and Greg Ostertag as the centers. Best players, Andre Kirilenko and Matt Harpring. This shouldn't be a good team, but somehow they came together, won 40 games and played tremendous defense and almost actually did get a playoff berth and got ninth seed in the end. So that might be my favorite season. It was also the first season I had tickets, so it was like, the newness factor was still there. But if you talk to like real hardcore jazz fans about that season, you get like a glimmer of excitement in their eye just because it was such a randomly fun year.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I'm glad you said that. As an outsider, my all-time favorite jazz player is Andre Kirilenko.
Oh,
I just
man.
Adored that guy.
Yeah, I mean,
like that was must-watch entertainment.
Yeah, right. And I mean, some of the stuff he does, you go back and watch Andre Kirilenko clips now, and there's not a player in the league like him now. I think in a lot of ways he was ahead of his time. As I don't know that people really envisioned him working as a small ball four, even though that's, you know, you put him in today's NBA and that's where he would be 100% of the time. And I don't think Jerry Sloan was really ready for that. But I mean, just the off weak side shot blocking was incredible. The passing was so cool. I mean, obviously the 5x5, the five of each statistical category, he did some things that no other player could really do. And we haven't really seen anyone like him since.
Yeah, you're right. He definitely was a man out of time. I definitely, I was looking at his basketball reference this morning and I was blown away that like his numbers weren't more incredible. Like I was like, I could have sworn he would have sort of averaged like, you know, like 6 blocks per 36 and all this stuff. But I do think if he was in today's game playing that, you know, all the time playing four, he would just be running up and down the court doing amazing things.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, like his peak was so short, I think is really what it was. Like it's that 02, 03, 03, 04 season. Then after that, once the Jazz signed Carlos Boozer, Darren Williams, Mehmet Okur, and start, he loses the ball. You know, he doesn't have it in his hands. He gets a little bit frustrated and gets a little bit hurt. I think the injuries hurt him a little bit, but like just that one or two peak seasons was really sublime. And then the rest of his career is like being a relatively good wing role player, you know, on a decent team.
Right. Bringing it closer to the present day, before we dive into looking forward to this upcoming season, I want to turn it back to my perspective. Since we don't know each other, I want to let you know where I'm coming from on the Utah Jazz. I got really enamored with the Jazz at the end of the 2014-15 season, you know, when they traded Enes Kanter, Rudy Gobert kind of showed up on the block. They finished the season incredibly well. They had, I think, the best defense post All-Star break. They finished that season as one, you know, I think one of the top teams in the NBA, even though they missed the playoffs. And so then that led into last season where I think under most metrics, and I don't know if you feel this way, but as an outsider, I felt like this past Utah Jazz season was a bit of a disappointment. It seems like in free agency last year, they kind of sat on their hands and they kind of were like, you know, Quinn Snyder came out and was trying to temper expectations to be like, you know, we might not make the playoffs. And I'm sitting here like, this team's going to be great this year. So what's your impression of last season? And did you think it was a disappointment?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I guess it was a disappointment that makes a lot of objective sense, you know, and I don't think that any of the individual players really underperformed. It was just kind of a situational thing where, you know, Dante Exum tears his ACL in August, and all of a sudden the fact that you have no point guard skills at all on the roster is really apparent. You start Trey Burke, who's a pretty bad NBA basketball player, and Raul Neto, who was, you know, a rookie from Spain who shot 20% from three over in his last year in the ACB. And then you lose 20 games to Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert to injury. And then all of a sudden you're starting guys like Trevor Booker, Trey Lyles, and backing them up with Jeff Withey and whoever you can get to fill those spots. And then you lose Alec Burks for over 40 games last year. So you kind of add up all the injury things and it starts to make sense. And then quite frankly, the team underperformed in close games too. You know, you just look at like a point differential and, the Pythagorean theorem thing says they should have had 46 wins. And you know, all of a sudden you're looking at if that's the case, they're the 5 seed in the West and they're playing the Clippers in the first round. And then, you know, if Clippers get hurt then still too, then you have a second round team all of a sudden. So it's like a little bit of unluckiness happened in both close games at the end of games and then obviously injury wise too, that kind of turned what was I think a good individual season by the individual pieces into a disappointment in not making the playoffs.
Right. And you guys missed the playoffs kind of. I mean, yes, there was throughout the season all those injuries, but then it came down to kind of excruciating fashion where you guys lost like a play-in game to the Mavs, and then you guys were on the wrong end of that, the shamockery that was right. Kobe's last game. So it was
Kobe's last game thing. I mean, by then it had been decided Houston had won the game before. So they, you know, that it was
right.
That's why it was the mockery that it was. But I think
right.
You look at that Mavericks game, you look at the Clippers game that they had that earlier that weekend, they lost to San Antonio the day before that by 2 points. I mean, it's really like a 2-point game, an overtime loss, and the Dallas performance that all of a sudden you look at what was playoff odds. If you look at like the ESPN playoff odds that Hollinger used to do or however their algorithm does it now. They were a 95% chance of making the playoffs. You lose 3 or 4 games in a row and all of a sudden you're out just like that in the space of less than a week. And, you know, obviously everyone around the team was disappointed, fans, players, coaches alike.
Yeah. It seemed like it was supposed to be the natural progression. Was like last year, they just make the playoffs and they're building to this year where they hope to compete. You mentioned you thought no player specifically was a disappointment. And this is probably just because I was too much of a bandwagon, you know, wide-eyed, getting excited with optimism. I actually, even though Gobert was kind of banged up, On our podcast, we half jokingly in the preseason last year named him our choice for, you know, most improved player, defensive player of the year, and MVP. We thought it was going to be all Jazz last year, but we didn't see when he played. And yes, again, we can write it up to injury. When he played, he didn't seem to make much of a big step from where he just first started playing the year before. So do you think? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that's absolutely a fair point. I think you're right that he probably did regress. I mean, I'll use the usual excuses of it was his first full season starting, as you pointed out, and if Kanter played most of the minutes for the first 3 months of the 2014-15 season. And I think the injury really kind of did hold him back athletically in the second half of the year, wearing the knee brace and kind of still feeling a little bit weird about his MCL, I think did limit him. But I think, you know, in some other ways, you can't blame his performance last year on injuries. I mean, like turnovers, for example, he somehow lost what Draft Express called incredibly good hands coming into the draft. All of a sudden last year, it seemed like he was fumbling every ball, kind of almost Timofey Mozgov-y for the Cleveland Cavaliers, where he just suddenly couldn't figure out how to be effective offensively. And I think teams also really started to figure out how to play him, right? Like, you can just leave him open on the perimeter and he's not going to hurt you. He's not such a good passer that you need to crowd him or anything like that. You can bring him out into the perimeter and he's okay in perimeter for how goofy and lanky he is, but he's, you know, not elite out there by any means. And I think as he became a bigger part of team scouting reports, he became less effective on both ends of the floor. And now it's really up to him to, you know, say, or to figure out how he can still be a good player, even when teams are game planning for him. He can't catch teams by surprise anymore, certainly.
Right. So do you think he's kind of approached maybe his ceiling, or do you think there's another step he can take? Like, I mean, he's still a very good defensive center and that's a great role to have, but do you think there's anywhere he can go?
Yeah, I think there are lots of places he can go. I don't know that he will do it. Right. But I mean, you look at like his jump shot in practice is surprisingly good. He shot literally only two jump shots last season, but, if he starts actually taking and making those, all of a sudden, maybe you can't leave him open from 15, 20 feet. He's working on a weird floater thing, which also allows him to get the rebound closer to the basket. Honestly, I think some of the hands things were just kind of an unwillingness to get low, because of the knee issue. And so if that starts getting to figured out and he kind of has that same sort of athleticism he did his first and second year, he starts to become a much more complete player. So I think there are some things that definitely can improve. I think game smarts is one of those as well. He is still a relatively young player, but you know, it's not a sure thing. And if, you know, even if he's the guy he was last year, where he's a top three rim protector in the league and is saving a lot of points at the rim, he's still a very valuable player. It's just whether or not, yeah, if he can take those kind of most improved steps, the leap to be able to be played on the offensive end of the floor in most game situations. You don't have to take him out of the fourth quarter. Maybe better free throw shooting might be another way he can improve. You can imagine a very, very important and effective Rudy Gobert where he's, you know, the first or second best, most impactful player on a team. I don't know that that's going to happen, but it's within my realm of dreaming as a Jazz fan and analyst, I guess.
And at the very least, he is at the top of his Twitter game. He's incredible on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. We just had an article about that on South City Hoops, actually. His Twitter and Instagram stuff is pretty great.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so moving on past Gobert, so now this offseason, the Jazz traded for George Hill. They signed Joe Johnson to kind of shore up some of those offensive problems they were getting from their backcourt. You know, I think they're obviously a lock for the playoffs, or at least they expect that. I think most NBA analysts would assume that. But making these trades, like trading a lottery pick and signing Joe Johnson, it seems they've moved now into like a legit win now mode. So what do you think the ceiling is for this team as they are presently constructed?
Like, the ceiling is actually really pretty good, right? Like, there are a lot of parallels drawn, and I think it makes sense that they are, between this year's Jazz team and the Pacers team of 2-3 seasons ago, where obviously you've got George Hill, the same point guard. You've got a really good versatile wing in Gordon Hayward, a good lead or second option kind of guy. You've got obviously a tremendous rim protector in Roy Hibbert or Rudy Gobert. David West and Derek Favors, you can draw some really interesting parallels to. And then you look at the Rodney Hood and Lance Stephenson comparison, and I think you hope for more from Rodney Hood than Lance Stephenson moving forward. So I think that's kind of what their ceiling looks like for this season. You kind of as a tier two contender, if you will, not, you know, definitely not a championship contender in a world that still has the Golden State Warriors and the Cleveland Cavs, but somewhere in there that you know, really could realistically make a conference finals or give a team a lot of problems in a conference semifinals. You know, you're looking at like ceiling here, 55 win team. Does that sound crazy to you?
No, oh, not at all. No, I'm really, again, but I mean, I was also the guy who was super high on him last year. So I guess I haven't made my actual, like, you know, sat down and all the team looked at all the teams' picks. Yeah. But I assume, like, I think they're going to be in the range for that, you know, anywhere like a 4 to a 6 seed is my expectation. So I'm pretty high on them. You know, I think because you mentioned the Pacers team a few years ago, they actually remind me of the Grizzlies, my favorite team from a couple years ago, where they seem like they're very deep. They don't have a good offense. So I don't know if they'll be built for the regular season for like 55 wins. Like in my mind, they're going to be that team that, like, you know, grinds out wins on their defense and scoring enough. But then when they get to the playoffs, they're that team where, like, no one wants to play them. You know, they could be like the 6th seed where, like, you know, the Spurs, the Clippers, whoever's fighting for that 2 or 3 seed is like, well, we don't want to face them. You know, like we don't want to mess with them. Cause I think when it gets to the playoffs, when things slow down, that's where, in my mind, the Jazz are really going to be tough. And, you know, that's where I see, you know, a signing like Joe Johnson coming in, you know, like, game slows down, he's going to grind out some points. And so for me, that, I think that might be the ceiling where they can make some serious damage and, you know, be an incredibly tough out for even the Warriors. I mean, the Warriors are going to have trouble grabbing rebounds, you know, playing against the Jazz, right? one of the best rebounding teams in the league.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. And obviously, no one's saying the Jazz are favored in that matchup. But if you just kind of look at what the Warriors struggle with, the Jazz check a lot of those boxes.
Yeah. Talking about Rodney Hood, is he still the clear-cut starter at shooting guard?
Yeah. He's really, really good. I mean, he's got such, like, an old man game that, I mean, I was a doubter of Rodney Hood going into the draft. I just thought his defense and game wouldn't translate to the NBA. I thought he would struggle with kind of a lack of athleticism, but he's so skilled from mid-range and outside. He's so smart in how he uses the pick and roll and puts the defender in jail by putting him on his back. He's a pretty solid defender. You know, I'd say he's an average wing defender, maybe a little bit above average, but that's certainly good enough. And I just, you know, some of the elevation he gets on his jump shot is pretty great. He still has definitely steps to go. He doesn't get to the line as nearly as frequently as you'd like. He doesn't finish that well around the rim. But in terms of just having those sort of, like, go and score sort of skills, it's really him and Gordon Hayward switching off clutch possessions at the end of last year. And they ended up being pretty efficient offensive scorers.
Yeah, and they also, both of them, had to do a lot of playmaking last year.
Yeah.
And I think everyone's hoping that that's where the acquisition of George Hill, a guy who in his time in Indiana was always, like, really malleable to his teammates. Like, he could play off the ball and just stand in the corner and would still score incredibly efficiently. So, yeah. The Rodney Hood thing, it's like, he's a guy that I feel like, I mean, I know this is the case with a lot of people, but he's a guy that maybe NBA writers are so high on that I'm almost wondering if, I don't know if he can become overrated when, like, the average NBA fan doesn't even know he's good.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that makes any sense. He he's the guy where I'm like, that guy's good. And also, he torches Memphis. So I always see him being like, wow, this guy's amazing. And then I check, right, his, like, oh, well, he didn't do that the last 5 games, you know, or something.
Right. And then, like, as a Memphis fan, obviously, you're looking at that 20 pick and 2 years ago and saying, you know, what could have been.
Right. I'm no Jaeger. I'm not worried about it. Yeah,
it's fine. But anyway, I think there's something to that where, like, he looks better than his stats are. And I think that's where you really go to the finishing around the rim and getting to the free throw line is things where, okay, now he's almost too good at the harder parts of scoring, like the mid-range shots that are beautiful, but they're, you know, somewhat inefficient to take. And if he can round out, he's got the hard part down. If he can round it out by getting to the line more, getting to the hoop a little bit more, then you'll see him take that next leap in efficiency that I think we all want to see.
Yep. What do you envision the rotations? I did see that you just posted on Salt City Hoops that an article about the Jazz rotations. And that's one of the funny things about this team. It's so deep.
Yeah.
And I almost wonder if the team is too deep, where, like, Quinn Snyder and his coaching staff are going to be like, there's legitimately dozens of, you know, reasonable options for lineups we can put on the court. So what's your estimation, or what's your guess for what, like, the main rotation is going to look like? Like, who's going to be first off the bench and such? And do you think it could be a problem that they have too many players?
Yeah, I mean, I I think it's a problem that'll work itself out really pretty quickly as soon as, you know, somebody gets hurt, which is going to happen, right? Like, there's been no NBA seasons where nobody got hurt. Some bench player will get hurt and, you know, you'll be fine. I think the Jazz have been so shallow for years now that having the depth is a change of pace for them, which is nice to see. But anyway, so your projected starting lineup is George Hill, Rodney Hood, Gordon Hayward, Derek Favors, Rudy Gobert. First off the bench,
right.
You're probably looking at George Hill. I think Dante X, or sorry, not George Hill, Joe Johnson. Apologize. Dante Exum probably takes your backup point guard and plays some two next to George Hill at times, along with Alec Burks, obviously playing a kind of a six-man scorer role at the beginning of quarters. And then Trey Lyles, you've got to expect to take a lot of minutes too at both kind of the four and five slots, backing up Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert. Boris Diaw could get time too. It kind of depends how he translates his game into the Utah system. So I think probably Joe Johnson is the guy that's most versatile, I suppose, out of the bench guys, and where you can kind of plug him in with the starting lineup. But you're right in that there are just so many options, again, looking at it today, where there aren't a whole lot of bad lineups for this team.
Yeah, no, that's great. You mentioned Boris Diaw. Like, that's a guy where it's like, I'm not sure how he fits in. Because even like Jeff Withey last year did really well in the time he played. I know the advanced stat people were like, this guy needs to play more. And then, like, you know, he was in while Gobert was out. And then he kind of fell back out of the rotation. Do you think, so Dante Exum is a guy I think a lot of fans are looking forward to and anticipate him improving on his rookie year 2 years ago, because he actually struggled pretty badly his first year. But is he healthy, and you think he definitely gets first shot at backup point guard?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any question in that. Jazz have kind of invested too much in him not to play him at backup point guard, even though Shalvin Mack and Howell Meadow played reasonably well last year. But yeah, I think Dante definitely gets those minutes, at least for the first few months of the season, to kind of see where he is in his game, to have him get over the ACL injury faster, kind of figuring things out that way. But I think they really make it a big push to get him 20 minutes a game, or maybe even more, even though he won't be, you know, even though you're going to be giving George Hill those starting point guard minutes. You look at him and he's just like, he's the biggest variance guy on the roster, right? Like, he could be legitimately terrible, or he's so athletic, so tall, so long. And you kind of look at why he was drafted as a potential superstar. And if he starts to fulfill those sort of expectations, then the sky is the limit for this team, right?
Yeah. Is Alec Burks still in the plans for the team, like, this season? Like, is he healthy? Is he someone, you know, because, like, this is a guy who has proven himself to be a good scorer in the NBA, and it's like he keeps getting hurt. You don't know if that's just bad luck or if he is, you know, you hate to say injury prone, but so is he in the plans?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's injury prone in just his style of play. I think he's so aggressive going to the hoop and getting fouled and those sort of things that he does end up getting injured fairly frequently. He's definitely in the plans to start the season. I think he's, you know, the kind of the go-to scorer in that bench lineup, you know, maybe along with Joe Johnson, but I think those guys can play off each other. The real question with him is whether or not he really helps you win in some sense. You know, like, his adjusted plus minus numbers are not very good. He's never been a guy who helps his defense out, and I think that's really what Quinn Snyder will make the decision on, who gets more minutes between him and Joe Johnson, and really Dante Exum at the two as well, is if Alec can figure it out defensively and be part of a team concept. He's always kind of frustrated his coaches with that, but now it's really his minutes are hugely at stake, because he could, you know, go down to like 5 minutes a game if he's not helping his team on the floor.
Yeah. All right. To kind of wrap up, I want to get to the two best players. It's funny, when trying to talk about the incredible depth of the Jazz, we don't even mention Gordon Hayward or Derek Favors. Derek Favors, maybe one of the most underrated players in the league, just because he doesn't seem to get much attention. But I'm not going to give it to him. I'm going to talk about Gordon Hayward, because he's going to be a free agent this coming summer, almost assuredly. Mm-hmm. You know that, and since they have traded, you know, George Hill on expiring contracts, and since this is a win now, is there any indication that this is like we have to do so and so well to keep Gordon Hayward, or is just the assumption that, you know, this guy, he likes his life in Utah, he likes the team, and we will resign him no problem?
No, I think, I think it's somewhere in between, right? Like, I think the acquisition of George Hill was absolutely motivated by an effort to be good this season in order to impress Gordon Hayward. You know, I think at the end of the season, Gordon Hayward and Dennis Lindsay, the Jazz executives, sat down and kind of talked about what his goals were for this year and really kind of his career. I think they realized at that point that they needed to put a team around him in order to keep him. I mean, remember, he chose to sign a offer sheet with the Charlotte Hornets over the Jazz, and the Jazz chose to match that as a restricted free agent. But it's not unprecedented for Hayward to go choose to sign a contract somewhere else. That being said, you kind of look at if the Jazz are as good as people hope they will be, as good as this team can be next season, then it's a no-brainer to stay. I mean, he does clearly like it here in Salt Lake City. He spent the summer here with new family, two new girls and new wife living here. So I think he likes it here and would prefer to stay here. But I think his ultimate career goals and honestly just level of competitiveness, if this Jazz team isn't as good as people hope and isn't a kind of what we talked about as a tier two playoff contender, then I think he ends up going elsewhere. I mean, right now I'd say that it's likely that the Jazz kind of live up to those expectations and he stays. But I've been kind of saying that there's like a 65% chance he stays, you know, like two thirds, that if things go well, yeah, sure. If not, you know, you could really see Gordon Hayward leave.
Two thirds isn't the confidence I was looking for. I mean, it seems like two thirds. Really? Well, I mean, I know you can't ever predict what an NBA player is going to do, but it's like, I don't know. I feel like I would be in the tough situation as a GM to be like, if there's a 33% chance that this guy's walking, like maybe I need to get like what asset can I get? You know, because I got a great front court already. Like, you know, if these guys come along, but again, it's hard to find wings in this league. You know, who can shoot, who can create, who can do all the things Gordon Hayward does. So yeah, it's a tough position to be in.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, if you're kind of looking at it from an asset point of view, it's hard because Jazz, like we talked about, are so deep, but they don't have the high level players, right? Of the super duper team. So if you want to get to that level, your best move is not trading away your best player, right? If anything, you need a consolidation trade rather than getting assets for your best guy. And so I think they'll definitely write it out until the summer and keep him and you know, make the best case they can. And I do, like I said, think it's likely that he stays, but it's not a sure thing.
Yeah. All right. Last question. If you could give Quinn Snyder or Gordon Hayward a new hairstyle, which one would it be and what hairstyle would you give them?
Oof. Quinn's hair is the best. I'm saying it's just like, it's so recognizable and so weird. And I know both of them spend too much time on it. So I'm going to go Gordon Hayward, and I want to see what Gordon Hayward would look like and to wrap the whole podcast up.
Yeah.
With an Andre Kirilenko-esque mohawk. How about that?
Yes. I love it. That's great. You're right. Yeah. Quinn Snyder has that whole murder face, dripping hair, curls and everything going on. We can't touch that.
That's why he's an effective coach.
Yeah, exactly.
The fear of God in his players. There was a timeout actually in his first season where he just straight up did not say anything to them, just stared at them. And then the Jazz went on like a 21-5 run and won the game in the fourth quarter.
My question is always, is he in physical pain when he's making that face? Like is the face voluntary? Cause it's like, it looks like he's just struggling, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah. I think sometimes he really is like angry and it just shows it. And then sometimes his face doesn't really reflect how he feels. I think it's a little bit of both.
That's great. All right. Well, Andy, thanks so much for your time. Tell people where they can hear you online and read your stuff and what's your Twitter handle and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So on Twitter at Andy B. Larson, I write for SaltCityHoops.com, ESPN Troop affiliate for the Jazz, and KSL.com, where I'm the Utah Jazz beat writer. The KSL is our NBC affiliate here in Salt Lake City. Then I have a radio show here on our ESPN radio station, ESPN 700, every Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. We post those all on saltcityhoops.com too.
All right, perfect. All you Jazz and NBA fans, make sure you follow Andy and all that stuff. All right, thanks for your time, Andy. Really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Big thanks to Andy for Talking Jazz. Make sure you check out his stuff. Thanks to FanEssentials.net and Rabble.tv. You guys out there, send me any off-season questions you might have to FastBreakBreak on Twitter or FastBreakBreak@gmail.com, and we will get to them and answer them. Like us on Facebook. Tell your friends about us. Okay, you guys are the best. Thanks for listening. And remember, breakfast is the most important thing.